Good morning, everyone. I think we're going to get started, even though usually at McGill we wait until 5 minutes after the bell. We'll start a little bit earlier than that, but on this beautiful Monday morning, I'm sorry to have those of you in the room cramped in a small space with the blinds closed, and those of you who are glued to your glued would be the strong word. Those of you who may be watching in the streaming of this to talk about yet again new challenges to McGill's financial situation. And they are continually evolving changes. I want to put some context around why we're holding town halls. The principal pointed out in September that when the first announcements of the cuts were made, we were not in a crisis. And many people are asking, has that changed? Where are we now? Other people have asked, how is this setback, and it is an additional setback that we've been given, different from the last major financial shortfalls which we faced during the initial period of cuts that were made in 2012, or even earlier, the crisis that we faced in 2009 and 10. There have been discussions with the ministry that have indicated that notwithstanding the fact that they have cut our budget in mid-year, they still expect that the budgets of the university system will balance. So that's a very large order because we've already allocated money to units, and the expectation is nonetheless that somehow we're going to be able to present to the government a balanced budget or a plan de redressement that we could use over the next 5 years to pay back any additional deficits that we run. Also, some people have actually asked, which was, I thought, really curious, after all of these years of presenting the budget and pointing out that McGill runs deficit budgets, there have been questions asked about, well, why don't we just have a rainy day fund that we could draw on in order to offset such surprises? Well, when you have a deficit budget, even if you run a surplus, as I'll point out in a couple of minutes, it just goes to reducing the financed portion of the debt that you owe. So you don't really have money to spend unless you had a surplus budget. And right now, I think there's only one university in the whole province that has a surplus budget accumulated over time. And then there's the question about how the university is addressing the issue of chronic underfunding with the Quebec government. And the principal has been very active on this portfolio together with Olivier Marcel and Michael DeGrappa and myself, trying to address with the government what we think some of the major issues are. But I also wanted to just put this in context, because much of what you read in the newspapers or on blogs are incomplete with regard to the picture that they draw. And it's important to get some terminology clear with regard to the way in which numbers about the university's finances are presented. When I present the budget to the Finance Committee and to the Board of Governors, as well as give orientations on that budget to Senate, I generally speak mostly about the operating funds of the university. That's because these funds are really unrestricted. That is, we can spend them on the things that we think are most important to spend. And we place them generally in a hierarchy with regard to our priorities. Other funds, and there are four altogether that make up the university's budget, but only the operating budget is truly unrestricted. The other funds all come with significant restrictions. The government gives us a capital grant, but we have to show that we've spent every penny of it on capital projects. The government, federal and provincial governments, as well as some research contracts, provide university professors with the opportunity to spend money on their research, but that's not money the university could use for other purposes, even in the short run. So those are totally restricted. And about 70% of our endowment funds go to helping students in one way or another, and another large portion, close to 25%, are meant to offset salary awards to professors who hold named chairs. So there's virtually nothing in the endowment fund that's unrestricted, and that portion that is unrestricted gets put into the operating budget of the university. So the only fund that we really have a lot of discretion on is the operating budget of the university. When we create a budget for the university, it is before the fiscal year in which we're living has actually ended, and it's months before we actually have the audited financial statements. And it is based on a set of expected revenues as well as expected expenses that we will undertake. But actual expenses and actual revenues are those that are recorded in the audited financial statements of the university. But both make assumptions. Okay? Even the audited financial statements have assumptions about certain liabilities and assets that the university has. And if we have shortfalls, particularly on the operating budget side, then we have to finance it. And in addition, on the operating budget side, because it's unrestricted, we sometimes have to make interfund transfers to cover expenses in the plant fund or to cover unexpected shortfalls in the endowment funding that would have otherwise gone to cover operations. So the only unrestricted fund we really have is the operating budget. Second, while we present the budget predominantly in terms of that operating budget, the generally accepted accounting principles under which we operate takes into consideration the university's total financial picture. It takes into consideration not only what we're going to do in a given year or even over a number of years, but it looks at the long-term assets and liabilities of the university. And some of those assets are the buildings in which we sit and therefore not available to us to use for other purposes. Some of them are long-term requirements and obligations that, while we don't have to pay them out immediately, have implications for the global financial picture of the university, including such things as responsibility for pension funds and increasingly for the deferred maintenance of the university's buildings. Terminology also needs to be clarified with regard to dates. Whenever we talk about a fiscal year, like 2014, it actually starts in May of the year before. So the fiscal year 2014 started on May 1st, 2013, ended on the 30th of April, 2014. But our budget starts the very next day for fiscal year 15. So again, we don't have fourth quarter results in, we don't have the audited financial statements for the university, and we have to make some assumptions about where our revenues are going to come from and what they're going to be, as well as to consider expenses and to approve certain expenses for the university based on the best available information we have at the time the budget is actually drawn up. So operating funds, generally accepted accounting principles, and fiscal years need to be kept in mind when we're talking about the university's financial situation. When we designed the budget for fiscal year 14, again, that's the one that ended on the 30th of April of this year, the budget book had in it a possible $10.4 million deficit. I want to underline the word possible. Because, as you know, we had just come out of we're living in a situation in which the Quebec government had cut about $57 million in revenue flow to the university over a three-year period. And therefore, we were uncertain as to whether or not expenditures could be undertaken in that budget, and they would be contingent on whether or not the government actually allowed revenues to flow to the university. So we asked the Finance Committee for the possibility of running a deficit of up to $10.4 million. We didn't allocate all of the expenses in the budget to things that we knew we would spend to get us to $10.4 million. We said if we have a revenue stream that warrants it, we would not have to use it. And if we absolutely needed to go into deficit, the Finance Committee was willing to let us go to a deficit of over $10 million. When the audited financial statements were presented to the Board of Governors in October, earlier this month, the year end on the financed side, on that operating budget side, showed a surplus of about $3.2 million. There's another way to interpret that, and again, that's the assumptive base I was talking about. These numbers don't really add up like your checkbook, right? There's an assumption of some expenditures that we didn't have to undertake, which have increased that surplus to $4.3 million. But the accumulated operating deficit of the university, while reduced by that 3.2 to $4.3 million, was still around $100 million. So that's our accumulated deficit. The university owes the bank, let's just use that as a shorthand for this, about $100 million on our operations. But our gap deficit, our generally accepted accounting principles deficit, while reduced in the last fiscal year by nearly $15 million, was still sitting at $272 million. So the university's balance of assets and liabilities weigh toward the liability side by just over a quarter of $1 billion. The surplus that we did generate on the operating budget side was the result of some positive variances being greater than the negative variances that we had. Sometimes we had to spend more than we thought we would need to spend on some things, and in other cases, we were able to see revenue flows to the university that we didn't anticipate. And they generally came from four different sources. First, we had higher enrollment yields that gave us more tuition and a slightly larger provincial grant than we expected. Second, the ministry itself recalculated money that it owed to McGill from previous years. That's a windfall, right? Because the finance committee and the external auditors don't like us to consider as a receivable the money that we might get from students who we record and submit to the government unless the government's actually given us the money. So we can't just put it in our books and say, oh, we're going to get the money, so it's a receivable. For these students, we have to wait till the money comes in, and we don't know when it's going to come in. And this, in fact, was a recalculation over a 3 or 4 year period. Also, there were increases in the sales of goods and services at the university. Now, some of that are the things that you'd already associate with goods and services, bookstore operations, parking, other things. Others are the things that have to do with education. So the Executive Institute of the Faculty of Management, some of the contract work that the School of Continuing Studies engages in overseas, those revenues were higher than we expected them to be, and that's a good thing because we'd encouraged the deans as well as the VPs to think about ways of bringing alternative revenues into the university. And finally, on the gap side, market performance far exceeded our expectations. And again, you don't know how markets are going to behave. In this case, they went up. But in the last little while, markets have been going down. So it's a variable, right? We don't know where it's going to be. So on the gap side, your liabilities can be affected by an improvement in the financial operations. So then it comes to fiscal year 15, the year we're living in. And we started again. We tabled the budget book in April. The Board of Governors approved it. It had been discussed in Senate and with the deans and VPs. And we anticipated that we would have operating revenues of about $768 million, of which $361 million would come from the government of Quebec via grants. And to be honest, we really thought that was a conservative estimate of how much we would get from the government. We didn't exaggerate it. We thought that's what we could really get, $360 million. We also anticipated expenditures of $776 million. But again, as we had done in fiscal year 14, we had some conservative estimates of spending in there. That is to say, some spending would take place if and only if the revenues that we thought we would get from the government actually materialized. And once again, a potential deficit of up to $7 million was granted to us by the Finance Committee and the full Board of Governors. And these budget allocations started on May 1st of 2014. It was prepared with the best available information, including a set of orientations, orientations from the ministry. The ministry, at the beginning of every budget cycle, tells us more or less, roughly, how to orient ourselves in preparing a budget based on what we're going to get from them. And then we have to make assumptions about the other sources of revenue. But they give us an orientation. That orientation is different than the final budget rules, which are written by the ministry and promulgated to all of the universities. And those things are yet different than the definitive calculation, the calcul definitif, that we get at the end of the budget year from the government, because they make additional transfers. So we're dealing with a moving target. Okay, we have an orientation from the government, then we have budget rules from the government, and then at the end of the year, we have a definitive calculation of how much they've actually transferred to us. But in order for us to operate as a university, financial authority is vested with the Board of Governors. The budget has to be approved by the Board of Governors on the basis of the estimates. They are not based on the actuals. The actuals come, as I said before, in the financial statements. So this is just, if you haven't, you can check these graphs and charts and explanations out in the budget book of the university, which is posted off of the provost's website, but also off of the website of the VP Administration and Finance. You can see that we expected that just under half of all of our revenues would come in through the grant from the Quebec government, 47%, the big blue side on that. So we thought that 47% of our revenues would come from the Quebec government, that $25 million, the bottom, would come from indirect cost recoveries from the federal government, that there would be gifts and bequests of about $5 million, sales of goods and services of $118 million, tuition charges, a third of our budget, would be about $255 million, some short-term investment income of $3 million, and some endowment investments of another $2 million. So that's how we thought the revenues would come in. When we look at the expense side, nearly 30% goes to academic salaries, 27% to administrative and support salaries, and $82 million is there as benefits. There's also about $37 million in student aid and student employment that's part of the budget of the university. Some special projects, about 20% is in non-salary expenditures at the university, and we put $9 million into special projects, and I want to emphasize that. Special projects, very round number, $9 million, was there if we got the revenues from the government. So when the principal said that it wasn't a crisis in September, and I still don't think we should interpret it as a crisis right now, but because we knew we had $9 million that we had put into the budget that we would expend if and only if the revenues actually came through. That's a cushion. A $9 million cushion that was purposely put there under the title of special projects. Now, in 2015, the changes were announced by the government to the orientation that they gave us in the form of the règles budgétaires. Those formal budget rules were only promulgated by the ministry to the university system on the 3rd of September. That's 4 months into the operations of the fiscal year, of the budget that had been allocated to the deans and the VPs, and via the deans and the VPs to administrative and support staff units and to the faculties, departments, and schools. So this comes 4 months in, and the grant that they announced was only $345 million for McGill. That's about $15 million less than we expected. So if we don't do anything with regard to the special projects, we're still going to fall short by about $6 million on this score. But it's a little worse than that. If the government cuts our grant in an undifferentiated manner and just says, you're getting less money, they can leave it to us to decide how to distribute it. But in this particular case, they were very prescriptive. Part of the cut comes from something called the RFA, which is the Rapport Financier Annuel. And in that report, they took some line items and said, we're cutting your budget by 2% on the administrative salary mass that's not based on instructional expenditures, and 3% of all of your non-instructional expenditures. So they actually went into the financial report that's submitted to them after our audited financial statements are made. We submit this RFA to the government. It's a slightly different accounting than we have been doing up until that point, budget, financial statements, RFA. When they get that, they then decided line items would have to be cut, and it included salary mass. This is very important that you understand this. It's the salary mass. It's not necessarily the number of people, although that's covered by Bill 100 and our expectations that 10% of the personnel in administrative and support staff positions over a five-year period would be reduced. Instead, this is the actual salary mass. So if we wind up the year not spending 2% less than when we started the year, the government will penalize us. So it's a hard-coded cut to our budget. The same is true for the 3% in non-instructional, non-personnel-related expenditures. Further, a couple of weeks ago, the government announced to the rectors of the universities and to the VPs, admin and finance, and the executive vice principals of other universities, that we should expect additional cuts to come in this year. So that original cut of $15 million to our grant was not the end of the story, that they were going to announce additional cuts that would be made sometime between that announcement and probably Christmas, a great gift for the holiday season, or no later, they said, than February. I want you to think about that for a minute. If they announce a cut in February and still expect us to balance our books by the end of April, I don't know, honestly, how to turn that into a balanced budget if the cuts come that late. The range is quite large about what those cuts could mean to McGill. It could be a $25 million cut to the whole system, in which case McGill would get a $4 million cut, or it could be a $75 million cut, in which case we would take another $12 million cut. So the worst case scenario that we're facing right now is an operating budget deficit that could reach $34 million. Now, if we go back to the distinction between the operating budget and the gap, this would be added to our gap. And if there were tremendous turnaround in our liability base, great reductions, it could actually lead to a gap picture that is not much different than it is now. On the other hand, it will be added to that gap deficit in the end of the year. In addition to that, the government said there will be further cuts in fiscal year 2016. The amounts and the specific items have not yet been determined. But trying to manage variances, both positive and negative, by the way, and that are due to cuts in the grant, make it very much more difficult when they come so late in a fiscal year. So that's the situation that we're facing right now. We know we have a $15 million cut. We know there's something else coming, could be as small as 4, could be as high as $12 million more. We know now that we'll probably have to dig into that $7 million that we had gotten as a cushion from the Board of Governors to do some things, but we also have those special projects which can offset some of these potential expenditures, but that's only $9 million, right? It's not enough to make it all up. Just to remind everybody, we do base the budget of the university, the allocations of the unrestricted funds, on our priorities. And the priorities come directly from the mission of the university, which is advancement of learning through teaching, scholarship, and service to society. And we have documents that tell us over the last decade what those priorities are and how we want to express them in our expenditures. They are the Strengths and Aspirations, ASAP 2012, the campus's master plan, our advancement plans, and most recently the principal's priorities. So we have mechanisms to guide us in the expenditures that we would like to undertake, but we also have now rules, the règles budgétaires from the government, that indicate certain line items have to be cut or we will face additional penalties. We also think that they are serious about balancing the budget, although I have to say, when you get budgetary rules that have two lines, one right after the other, that say all universities are expected to balance their books in fiscal year 15, and the next paragraph starts by saying, in the case in which a university doesn't balance its books, there has to be a plan de redressement. So we're actually trying to figure out where in this cycle we will find ourselves, probably with a plan de redressement rather than a balanced budget. But we have to try to do our best. So another set of questions that have often come up in this context is we made some savings through the voluntary retirement plan, and has that put McGill in a better position to deal with these additional cuts that we've seen? So the short answer is maybe. And the reason it's a maybe is we have seen a growth in both the salary mass and the number of replacement positions in the administrative and support staff positions that were cut, eliminated, by the voluntary retirement program. We've added over $1 million in the first quarter to the salary mass, and the replacement rate has been, in those areas that have made the requests, I think an astounding 1.6 to 1, rather than the reverse, which would have been 2 vacancies, 1 replacement. We're going in the opposite direction. So in order for us to say that the VRP has made a difference, we need to show constraint and to solidify McGill's relatively sound base. I want to emphasize that. The reason the principal said for us it wasn't a crisis and why I said just a minute ago it isn't yet a crisis is we have a strong base. We took the serious medicine, right? We took that cough syrup that tastes so bad, and we took the cuts. Other universities in the system didn't take the cuts. And you can tell from the tone of the newspaper articles that are appearing and the press coverage of other universities that they are really reeling at the thought of having to take those earlier cuts in addition to the present cuts and have a plan de redressement that addresses now almost 3 years of significant cuts. We took the medicine. We have a better base than most, but it's not it's not that solid, and we have to do things to make sure it stays solid. Right now, there's no immediate plan to claw back monies that have been allocated to units. As I say, we're not going to say we gave it to you, now we're going to go in and pull it back. The clawbacks won't be there, but there's going to have to be restraint on the way in which those monies are spent. The university has an obligation to meet its promises. The pay increases that have been promised have to be maintained. And those go on over a number of years. So unless there were legislation telling us not to plan a budget that includes the pay increases, we're going to plan the budget for next year to include them. But that means we're going to have to cut from somewhere else to keep those promises and to meet reasonable expectations about how the university should function. We have to develop a reasonable and responsible action plan that is based on our strategies, our mission, and our aspirations. We have begun undertaking very detailed analyses of anticipated expenditures. And we're doing something that we haven't done in the central administration for some time, which is actually looking at expenditure patterns at the local level. Because unless we have a better handle on where expenditures are taking place, it always comes too late because there's no approval path for a lot of the expenses that are in budgets that have been allocated to local units. I said before, some of our expenditures were defined as contingent, and those we will try to pull immediately. Other expenditures that were approved may be able to be postponed, right? So we will leave the expectation that the expenditure can take place, but we won't do it in fiscal year 15. We'll put it into the budget for fiscal year 16. So, you know, since 2009, McGill's budgets have consistently been more austere than those of other Quebec universities. And we're starting to plan how to address cuts now when we don't even know their full scale. And I mean address cuts for 16 as we plan the budget, as well as try to figure out where we are in fiscal year 15. We're going to try to hold on to what we have by positioning our deficits in the middle of the pack. That's been our pattern at McGill. We've been conservative, but we've always tried to not get too great a distance between the way in which our financial situation plays out on an annual basis and the way in which it looks at the University of Montreal or Laval, our two other U15 universities in the province. So we try to look at the ways in which, and we share information with them about certain types of expenditures. It's clear, however, that these cuts coming 4 and potentially as far as 7 months into the fiscal year will have significant financial implications for administrative units, faculties and schools, and departments. Development of a budget for fiscal year 16 and figuring out how to handle the remainder of 15 will require some serious reconsideration of the assumptions we had when we built the budget and the anticipated expenditures. In addition to regular input from VPs and deans, we may need some additional consultations. And I want to say that in the previous rounds, whenever we've held consultations with the community, actions that have been suggested by these kinds of gatherings have found their way into our budget. A simple example is that one of the suggestions that came out of an earlier round of consultations was to try to put in new monitoring devices on our electrical systems in buildings and to have light switches that were more intelligent. And by making that capital investment, we've actually seen some reductions in the costs of energy at the university. That's a good suggestion. It does require an investment, but the investment pays for itself. So you want to have those kinds of suggestions coming from people like yourselves who live the everyday experience in the faculties, departments, and units. In addition, we know, however, as I just pointed out, that the expectation of the government of Quebec when we file our RFA for fiscal year 15, a year from now, that they expect to see zero growth in the salary mass for administrative and support staff positions. And that's part of the line item cuts that they have imposed. And that's one of the things that we have to address. Many people have asked another question. The provost gets up and he gives us a high-level discussion of the finances of the university. But how do we connect the dots between that high-level information and the actual local realities that we have to live every day? And will the decision-making around any cuts that have to come be transparent to all those people involved? And we're trying to connect the dots for you, but it is very difficult. Every local unit has a slightly different circumstance. And at the level of the university, the provost's office budgets to the deans and VPs, and we don't usually get into budgeting at the local level in departments, schools, centers, of course those are mostly research expenditures, or administrative units. But as information becomes available, or where we have to take actions, the community will receive updates, potentially directly from the principal, from myself, or from Vice Principal DeGrappa. We need to restrict our spending, and announcements will be made in January in time for planning implementation for fiscal year 16, but we need to control expenditures in fiscal year 15. Fiscal year 16, the primary budget planning objective will be to minimize the effect on our academic programs, which is the source of our reputation, our reach, and of course our revenues, if students fail to come. If professors fail to generate research grants, then revenues go down. So we need to be conscious of that. The revenue-generating mechanisms that are available to the university in its traditional business are teaching students and professors conducting research. Those both bring revenues to the university. Philanthropically, We do get support, obviously, it's important, and but it's not to cover the basic operations of the university. It goes into special activities. So we need to remember that. The reach, reputation, and revenues come from the instructional portion of the university and from the research activities of professors. So there are some measures we have to take immediately, and it is a time of uncertainty, but these are not easy announcements to make. First, we have to put a freeze on all new searches for external hires for administrative and support staff positions. So if there's a position that's already been advertised and the position, as of today, don't put them in today because they won't go through. So if they've already been advertised, then the process can continue. Second, we know it's been really difficult in many units because of the VRP. But we've also seen, as I pointed out earlier, increases in that salary mass and requests also for reclassifications, which add to the salary mass. It's only fair that if a person is doing more work than was anticipated in their job classification, that they be subject to a review and have the opportunity to have their increases recognized. It's not fair to hold that back. But we have to have a mechanism in place that ensures that it is really a reclassification. And I mean that, I'm trying to be gentle about this, but we have to have procedures in place that guarantee equity across the university in terms of the way in which those reclassifications are made, because they can be substantial in terms of the financial implications on the salary mass for administrative and support staff positions. We also want to postpone all non-essential equipment and furnishing purchases from operating funds, 1As through 1Fs. We want, once again, and we did this 3 years ago, but we want to further reduce travel and hospitality spending to the minimum essential. And we also are going to stop all in-year allocations. That's money from the contingency funds that go to other units for additional expenditures. We're only going to make those transfers if it is a true emergency, and you can imagine we have one when we were propping up a wall or holding up a portico in the arts building or we're propping up a wall in the McDonald Stewart Library building. Those are emergency expenditures that weren't anticipated by the capital budget, and we need to provide some additional support for them. So true emergencies and mission-critical urgencies will be considered. But all of those 5 points will be reconsidered in January based on where we stand. And we will know better by January, we hope, what the additional cuts will be. Will they be at that $4 million range, which will make things difficult but not quite impossible, or will they be at the $12 million range, which will make things almost impossible in terms of balancing the budget or coming within the $7 million deficit that we projected? We need to take concrete measures now because there is, and I put it in brackets here, there's a false availability of money. We allocated money to the units on the basis of assumptions that we thought were conservative, only to wind up having $15 million more taken away than we thought. And being told that we may lose between $4 and $12 million more dollars. So there's no real availability. If that money got spent now, it would go to the bottom line immediately, and we would be in trouble when we submitted either our audited financial statements to the board or our RFA to the Quebec Ministry. We want to avoid units rushing to spend, which is why I said we're announcing them today. They're in effect as of this morning, all five of those measures, plus the fact, however, we're not clawing back revenues that have been allocated, because if you don't spend them, then, again, we're not going in and clawing it back. But we don't want the reverse to happen, that people will rush into expenditures now, hoping that things will get better in January. We also want to avoid unpleasant consequences with the ministry at year end. We had an unpleasant consequence with the ministry at last year's year's end, even though we did quite well from the point of view of the financial statements of the university. We did not get our conditional grant by the end of fiscal year 14, it was allowed by the external auditors to be considered as a receivable, but we didn't get it. The government didn't expend it. They didn't expend it until fiscal year 15. So we have to be careful about that because that puts us in a precarious situation with regard to our day-to-day finances. And we don't want to be in a position, if we don't take these measures now, we could wind up in a position where fiscal year 16 could be even tougher. So we already had a VRP, and the intention of the VRP was not to replace the positions that that were eliminated because of the voluntary retirements, but rather to rethink the way in which we work. I know that's difficult. I'm not trying to make it sound like it's easy. But we have to do it. We have to work smarter, not harder. We have to think about ways in which we can eliminate those things that are no longer viewed as mission critical to the operations of your units locally or to the university globally. So we want to move in that direction. There are many other questions that people have sent in or have been raised or we've heard through the proverbial grapevine. We know you're having a difficult time with reorganizations, and now there may even be fewer staff positions and resources available. How are we going to manage? These cuts cannot we can't really manage these cuts simply by not hiring new staff or by postponing job reclassifications. Our jobs at risk. We've always maintained that that's a last resort, right? At McGill, job losses, involuntary job losses, remain last resort, and we will try to do everything we can to preserve positions at the university for those who hold them. The academic units right now are not being, academic units meaning academic hires, are not being asked to postpone the professorial searches that are already underway, but we are reconsidering how many of those searches we will be able to undertake in fiscal year 16. Twice in the last 10 years, we have hired fewer people, fewer professors than those who left. And we may be in that situation in fiscal year 16. But for 15, the searches will go on. And as I said earlier, we're building a budget on the basis of maintaining promises for pay increases. But the funds have to come from somewhere, so they will mean additional cuts elsewhere. The cuts will affect students. Yeah, I think that's they will. We cannot. The equation that I showed you earlier about how the government funds us is on the basis of a grant based on FTEs, full-time equivalent students, and WSUs, weighted student units. So part of it is just how many students you have, count their heads. And the other is how many courses are they taking in specific disciplines. The government gives us funding on the basis of activity. But the government controls most of the tuition revenues as well. The government tells us how much we can charge Quebec students. The government tells us how much we can charge Canadian students. And in the regulated programs for international students, the government tells us how much tuition we can collect. And we have to rebate that in a forfaitaire back to the government to the Quebec level. So we're controlled on the tuition side as much as we are on the grant side. We will try not to reduce services where possible, but some services will simply have to be reduced by their very nature. It's not, unless we find alternative revenue sources for some things, we might not be able to, give an example, keep the library open 24 hours a day all the time. It may only be restricted to midterms and final exam periods. We also know that there will be some implications for a classroom, our classroom redesign projects may have to be put on hold, although we have an antiquated set of classroom facilities that we really want to upgrade, and so we have to think carefully about whether or not we can do that. And we don't want to cut graduate funding because graduate students are part of the raison d'etre of a research-intensive university. Deans, chairs, and directors have a role to play by looking carefully at the expenditures in their units. I gave examples of them. Do you have to ask for an admin and support staff position? Can you think of a reclassification or recomposition of jobs that doesn't involve reclassifications? Can you cut your travel expenditures? Can you cut your entertainment expenditures? Can you think about alternative ways of organizing work? So those are things that are there. we have a very ambitious academic mission, and we're trying to do it with less relative dollars than we've had in the past. And our peer institutions in Canada are now facing some very similar crises to our own. In British Columbia, the University of British Columbia is not able to spend its nominal surpluses because even though the university has been in a financially balanced situation, the provincial government is not, and their budget rolls up to the provincial government. So they're being restricted in terms of the expenditures of their surpluses. Universities in Ontario are facing additional cuts and requirements based on the financial situation in Ontario's moving from a very favorable have province to a middle of the pack and potentially have not province. So there are other competitors who are also challenged. The Americans are waking up. They were, for a long time, Canadian universities were doing much better than our American counterparts, but the public sector in the United States took the big hits 4 and 3 years ago and are now turning around. So we can't rest on our laurels, and therefore all of our expenditures have to be targeted to improving our reputation and our reach, because that will, in fact, again, help our revenues. The rest, I said, only half of our revenues come from Quebec, but another third are controlled by Quebec. So we're in a pretty dominant situation, a publicly underfunded university, and we have to think carefully about where we're going to go. So I will stop there and take questions, comments, suggestions, listen to your concerns, and I know there'll be criticisms and complaints. Yeah.
Just a comment. And we will continue to do that, but we see it very much as being the university's responsibility to provide that service. But related to the 2% cut mandated by the government on salaries, I know some of that is in the voluntary retirement program, approximately 1.6, but of the remaining portion, how is that allocated between senior administrative staff, departmental staff, lower administrative mm-hmm. staff, and whose decision-making process is that?
Sure. So there are a couple of things. The security and other things that go into 24-hour access are not only paid by students. So the university does provide an operating grant to the library for services. Second, it is that the senior administration has already begun a process of reorganization. We have something called shared services on the fifth and sixth floors of the third, fourth, fifth, the James building, except one floor. So the James building already has had a process of shared services, and we've reduced, I think, from 6 to 2 or 3 the number of employees who are working in providing those services. And so we're looking for everyone. We start with ourselves. The principal said you start by making the cuts in the James building, and the reorg starts there, and then you promulgate it out. So the decision-making about the number of positions is right now we're going to be in a freeze, and we're going to have to look at the ways in which we can redistribute work and have a reorganization plan that will make sense for the university.
So our unit is pretty much at capacity. Our staff is working at their limits, and our teaching support is quite minimal. Do you see the university as thriving, and if not, what are your plans to help it thrive?
So I think the university right now, notwithstanding these financial problems, the university is thriving. We're doing very well in terms of our international reputation. Slippages in rankings don't really worry me that much. Those are statistically artifacts in many ways. The university's reputation is quite good. Our ability to attract professors has probably never been better in terms of the number of applicants we have for positions that we fill. The quality of the professors is excellent. We have the best students at the undergraduate level in all of Canada by everybody's standards in terms of votes. Queen's is close, but we're number one in terms of that. So I'm very optimistic about McGill, and I think that we're doing quite well. It is a time to rethink the way we do things. So it's not going to be me or the central administration alone who helps the university not only to survive but to thrive in these conditions, and that means rethinking the way in which we do things at every level. Any other questions? Yes.
It's a suggestion, and thank you for this, Tony. I've always wondered when professors arrive, there's a startup fund allocated to them. I don't know what the stats are of departures within 2-3 years, but I know within the vicinity of my own department, there have been quite a few. So it's a waste of money, really. You invest in individuals, and then the money disappears. So I'm wondering if there are ways that we can allocate these funds to student support rather than other kinds of setups, like lab setups and so forth. So at least the monies are not wasted.
That would be very tough to do, just to be really clear. First of all, what McGill has, we looked at the comparative statistics, and our planning institutional analysis group has run some comparative survey data with AAU universities in particular, looking at our turnover rates. And they're actually lower than the average for both the U15 and the AAU, the American Association of Universities. So we have lower turnover than you might think. We do have turnover, it's clear. People come, they're hired, they don't renew for a variety of good reasons. Most of the reinvestments that are made, the equipment stays if we invested in plant and equipment, so it can be reutilized. So I don't think it's a waste. And plus, if professors have lab sciences, it's impossible to expect them to get their research going without providing startup grants that get their space organized well and the equipment as well as student support in there. We've moved McGill from using only about $2 million in operating budget support to almost $30 million to support graduate students. So I think we've been trying to go in exactly that direction to make sure that graduate student support is there. So I don't think we can stop giving people startup packages.
No, I wasn't suggesting that. I was thinking maybe there are ways of thinking of using that investment in a way that stays here and doesn't just disappear because the individual...
Right. But if they leave, they can't take it with them. Any other questions? Yes.
Do we know, Mr. Cobos, at this point, if the 2% and 3% are to be applied only to 1A funds?
Yeah.
Or do they apply across the board to the expenses we incur?
It's right now, the way the RAF is submitted, it's all expenses, not just 1A funds. So it means that's a very, and that we have written a letter of complaint to the government about that. For those of you who don't understand the question, let me describe it. The 1A funds are generally those funds that come from the allocation made from the Quebec grant, including the teaching and tuition grant. B through F funds are generally those funds that units may raise on their own from other sources. And those funds are also considered as part of our expenditures for administrative and support staff. So we complain to the government, how dare you tell us what to spend money on that you don't give us? If you want to cut us on the money you give us. Don't cut us on the money that we go out and raise on our own. Because it's, again, if you look at just the other side of that ledger, from the government grant, it's less than 50% that they're providing us. And when we put additional money in, go back to the first question of the students, if we have to put additional administrative and support staff into paying for 24-hour service, even if the students themselves pay for it, it's considered part of our expenditures and therefore is subject to a cut. So we're really worried that if the government gets this prescriptive about line item cuts, that we're on a treadmill, or it's a downward spiral, because we've put money into things that provide a better quality of life for the university, having a better library service being certainly one of them. And our students have been very supportive of that. So why, you can't tax them twice. I'll give you another example. We already are taxed by the federal government on the indirect costs that we receive, indirect cost recoveries. We only get about 17 cents on a dollar, right? But if you're at a university that has less research because they recognize certain fixed costs, you might get 24 cents. If you're a very small university, you might get 80 cents. So there's an inverse curve with an inverse line. It's inversely proportionate to the amount of research that you generate. when that money goes into an expenditure, like maintaining an office for research activities or outreach activities, or providing support services to professors to fill in their grants, that position is then counted against us by the Quebec government. So they didn't give us that money, but they're counting it as part of our administrative and support staff functions. We're fighting them, but it's very hard. It's not David and Goliath in this case. It's that there's no one who hears worse than a person who doesn't want to hear, right? So we're not having a great time making that case. Anyone in the back? Yes.
Two questions. First of all, on the regarding the measures that you just announced,
right?
Are those measures to counter the $15 million shortfall, but not yet measures that would counter the additional potential $4 to $12 million shortfall? So, there might be other measures.
We'll give it. That's why it says in bold: reconsider the above actions in January based on where we are. So right now, they might be able to address both ends of that. We just don't know how big those other cuts are going to be. So right now, we think that that combined with not spending on some of the priorities, and assuming we don't have any terrible emergencies that we have to attend to, right, in the short run, that we might find ourselves in January saying, we've managed through this, we see what the cut is, it's only $4 million, we don't have to go on. If it's $12 million, we may have to continue into the next fiscal year as well. Does that answer your question?
Yeah. Second question. The whole plan de redressement idea,
yeah.
So it sounds like you're saying we're probably not going to come in with a balanced budget, and we probably will submit a plan de redressement for whatever in the next 5 years. So the question is, what has to be shown in a plan de redressement?
So we actually began this process every year. We're asked with, we usually submit a plan de redressement because we're running a deficit budget for the most part. Even when we have a surplus on operations, we have certain gap expenditures which continue to rise, and we have to show how we're addressing those as well. So a plan de redressement, we actually submitted one years ago when the first cuts came through, and we took them. Remember I said at the beginning, we took the bad medicine early, and one of those things was with the VRP and with other controls on our expenses, we were going to fix McGill earlier than the other universities did. We didn't take a somersault into the fiscal year. Let me just explain that. Our budget year starts on May 1st. The government's budget year starts on April 1st, right? The Poisson d'Avril, right? So they start earlier. And because there's a gap, you could play off when you receive money from the government or when they give it to you in the short term. Eventually, you have to pay back all of your deficit. But in the short term, you could roll that over. We did not take advantage of that when it was made available to us. We said, look, our finances are our finances. We know where we stand. We have to fix them ourselves because we're not going to get help. So we took the difficult decisions, including a VRP. That's not an easy thing to decide to do. Those are 256 positions across the university that we plan not to fill. We know that that's difficult. But we did it because we thought we'd get on a solid financial footing. The $19 million the government cut from us in two of the three previous fiscal years, we knew it was not coming back. And we didn't build our budget last year assuming it was coming back. Every other university in the province, as far as we can tell, assumed that the cuts were temporary, that they were going to be reinstated, and then there were going to be further reinvestments. We made no such assumptions. So we took a very, and I'm not going to be apologetic about it, we took a very conservative approach to what we thought financing would be. In fact, I can't be apologetic about it because it's even worse than I thought. Other questions? Yes.
Somewhat of a follow-up. Do you see the support staff at its limits, and do you see teaching support as being high or low or medium?
I look, every single one of the, if I could, I would, but I can't, so I won't. The issue is, I think it's low, and I'd like to see it improve, but I have to have the resources to do it. So unless we find the way to get those resources in, I think we're going to wind up being in some difficulty and surviving rather than thriving. But that's not now, and it's probably not next year. In the next couple of years, we have to solidify the base, and we have to begin to move as many of our expenditures to the priority items as possible. And that's why the emphasis is on the delivery of our academic and research programs. It's the only way we're going to maintain our reputation and our reach and potentially generate additional revenues. We've convinced the Quebec government that what we do with international students is different than anywhere else in the province. We have four programs that are deregulated for international students. That means we get no grant for those students in science, engineering, management, and law. Law is a very small component of that for international students. We think that deregulation should occur for all international students, and we're working with the government about ways in which that could occur. That would leave additional revenues with the university. So we're working to get a change in public policy to help us. We're asking for flexibility. That we know. I think everyone who sits around the principal's table knows that the Quebec government is in financial straits, the difficult straits. Dire straits. They're not going to find money to just give to universities. They've got a healthcare system that also is being cut. They have infrastructure that needs to be attended to. We understand that. We're not asking them just to open up their purse, you know, and give it to the university. We're saying, let us help ourselves. Give us the opportunity to raise money, increase revenues from other sources. But don't be so prescriptive about things like 2% from this line item and 3% from that line item, and no, you can't touch international tuition, and no, you can't touch other revenue sources without our permission. We're trying to get flexibility to help us address the issues you just raised. Yes?
Where does McGill stand legally regarding these line item budget reductions? Because it sounds like it's a fairly unusual situation where the government says you must reduce this item and this item, and it also sounds like we don't have much recourse. Yeah. So what is the public policy? What is the law regarding?
I think if we get into a situation in which we try to fight the government on the basis of a legal battle, we will lose bigger. It's really not worth it in that sense. The ministry has a lot of leeway in the way in which it allocates resources. And they have a law, they had Bill 100, which was actually very prescriptive in the fonction publique about cutting 10% of positions over a five-year period, positions, and therefore also cutting the salary mass. In this particular case, our objection was you should cut it only if you give it. If we have it from another source, please leave us alone. Our students need to have libraries open. Don't cut the security staff there because we're going to have to spend it there anyway. Don't tell us that we can't provide additional support to our researchers because we get it from the federal indirect costs. If you want to cut us on the things you give us. So that's the battle line there. But it's really a conversation, but they're not listening very carefully. Yes?
Sorry.
It's very difficult to get all of the universities in Quebec to line up. There are two basic types of university in Quebec. There is the University of Quebec system, which, even though it has a different fiscal year, rolls up into the government, right? It's a government entity. And then there are the charter universities, McGill, Concordia, et cetera. And we sometimes have common interests and we sometimes don't. So, you know, we look to the University of Montreal as the two big research universities. Do we have some common ground? And our principal works with the rector at the University of Montreal, I'm assuming on a daily basis, but I know at least weekly, to try to line up our vision about this. It hasn't helped that I won't say that. It's not a good idea to be too public about some of those debates.
Yeah.
But it's important that there's an alignment of interest on the things that we truly share in common. And our principal is very, very active on that front. Yes?
I have a question about the salary mass.
Mm-hmm.
what are they referring to specifically? Are they talking about the number of FTEs that need to be reduced, or they were talking about both the actual salary that needs to be reduced? And I guess, given that, what are we reading in between the lines in terms of why the government is cutting this? Are they viewing all universities as overstaffed, and they feel that this is, like, why are they cutting this? We should know, we should have an understanding of why.
I think that there are two, it is the salary mass, the total, so that's why even if you stuck to the same numbers but you increased the salaries you're giving to people, you're going to exceed the salary mass. They also think that there should be cuts in the number of administrative and support staff positions. And it doesn't help that there are some people, some professors at other universities, who are out there saying, well, you know, university professors are underworked. They don't teach enough. They don't have enough support. And that's what we hear in the French press recently. And I think that that doesn't, it completely ignores the research burden that's on our professors or the activities in which they're engaged to provide a service to society. It thinks of it as if they were high school teachers. These are professors. These are researchers. So they, on the support side, they think that we're, like the public service, they think that universities are, in fact, overstaffed. And when they look at things like the long-term liabilities, they look at your present salary mass and your present FTEs, and they say, how are you going to pay for them in the future with regard to pensions? And we think we're in a different situation with regard to the pension, right? Because we have a defined contribution plan that kicked in for anyone hired after 2009, and we have only a defined benefit minimum for the remaining staff. But it's a defined contribution plan. Only McGill and Sherbrooke are the only two universities that have that. So we shouldn't be lumped into the same pile with everybody else. But that goes back to the earlier question, then where do we align? So if McGill and Sherbrooke align on pensions and McGill and Montreal on research, that then we don't always find
the
same. We don't find common ground. Yes?
I'm just curious, do you also expect cuts in the capital budget as well?
So we don't, we hope not. I'm looking at Robert Couvrette, who's sitting in the front row. We don't think that the government is going to touch the capital budgets right now, but they are inadequate as they stand, in particular for a university like McGill that has so many buildings that are small and old. And I guarantee you that with aging, things deteriorate. So we have a serious problem at McGill that is not faced by some of the universities that have more modern facilities. So we're concerned about that. We're also concerned about where we're located. On the historic and cultural district of Mount Royal, we have obligations about how we can fix things that aren't present for universities that don't reside in such a beautiful district. I mean, look, this is a gorgeous campus from the outside, except for the parts that are collapsing. But it comes with a cost, and that's not recognized in the way the government provides funding. No building in any Quebec university is more than 49 years old. Yes.
I mean, as you indicated, this is not a new thing. We went through the same in the last 3.5 years. So I have two questions with regards to what we gained from that experience to tackle this one. One is, how successful were we as an institution to explore and increase revenues, new sources of revenues,
right,
in response to the previous cuts? And do you think, the new sources of revenue that now we can explore that we didn't explore then?
Those are really good questions. One is, I think we have increased our sales of goods and services, and that's not just selling dormitory rooms to students, right, or renting them. It is a revenue stream that comes in through activities in continuing studies, the Executive Institute of the Desautels Faculty of Management, to other teaching and teaching programs through the Faculty of Medicine. So there are a variety of activities that we're engaging in now that we had before, but which have now increased in intensity. And that helped our financial results at the end of last year considerably. There was almost a $14 million swing just in the sale of goods and services. Now, they come with expenses, too, so it's not net, but you can see that we're moving in that direction. I think the things we have to think about are how do we protect our core mission? And this is where chairs and directors in particular can play a role. How do you protect the core mission of the university and not overburden professors while thinking about additional instructional programs that might be offered? We have the highest proportion of doctoral students to tenure track staff and as a percentage of our overall student body of any university in Canada in the U15. And that's because we're really research intensive. But we don't have that same ratio for all graduate students, which means that the other universities have figured out a way to use their professional master's programs in particular as a source of additional student revenue. So you can't do things that aren't part of your core business, because that's not going to be helpful if we started doing all kinds of consulting and other activities. It's really about we're good at what we do. We deliver high-quality programs. Do we have some that we've underexploited without, again, it burdening the research mission or the quality of our undergraduate instruction? Yes?
A possible suggestion on how to save some money and or time. Looking at streamlining processes, I know like hiring is a very time-intensive process that our unit undertakes, and yep. So there are lots of other processes that are
right.
Not necessarily the most streamlined.
That's a good idea, and I think we have undertaken exploration of how my workplace and the ways in which we could streamline processes. I don't mean to deviate or to push this off for a second, but there's some things that are simply mandated that we have no choice about. So, for example, if we're hiring professors and they come from outside of Canada, then there's a whole process of reporting that we have to be engaged in that is mandated by federal and provincial rules, and we have to follow them. If we want, in all of our searches, we have to keep statistics on the composition of the people who've applied for the job. These add burden, I understand that, but they're actually mandated, and they're unfunded mandates, right? They're not that, oh, we'll give you some additional money or positions to handle them. You have no choice. We've asked the government, one of the first things that the principal did when she took her job was to look at the reporting burden of the Quebec government on universities. And this is one where all of the universities agreed that the reporting burden is actually inversely proportionate to the amount of money we receive. As the proportion of the Quebec grant has gone down, the amount of paperwork we have to file has gone up. I just gave you on the budget, we get an orientation, we get a règle budgétaire, and we get a calcul définitif. I mean, it continues. And again, when they start doing line items on the RFA, it adds another burden because we have to cross-check that. It's extremely labor intensive. All of these things really require, but it's the labor that we can't ask professors to do, and yet they're telling us we should cut our admin and support stuff. So I think we have to be, again, fair to the government. They're in a financial crisis that they're trying to address. All we're asking for is to help, let us help ourselves by giving us some flexibility. We're not asking them to open up their wallets. We can figure out ways of generating additional revenues that are based on our mission, if you let us. Again, professional master's programs might be one. Deregulation of international students at some additional level would be another for McGill. And additional activities that, again, are part of what we do. Sorry, yes?
We've talked about the short-term deficits up to now, but there's an accumulated debt that you've talked about,
yeah.
$100 to $200 million. And that will require more in-depth resolution, it seems to me. Are you thinking,
yeah,
of selling assets and closing down academic units?
So, you know, we've had, as a proportion of our budget, we had, when we really were in a crisis was, let's call it 1994. In 1994, we had almost a $100 million deficit on an operating budget that was half this size. And we had interest rates that were much higher in the short run. So a $100 million financed deficit on an annual basis cost the university in operating budget terms probably less than $3 million, a lot less than $3 million. And on a budget of $700 million, that's 0.5%. So right now that deficit, from my point of view, I wouldn't mind running it up if it were in the service of investing in the university's future. Now, I won't be able to. They won't let me run it up in my last year as provost. But, I mean, I think we have to be very conscious of the fact that we've invested in our future by having a deficit like that at a time when interest rates are low. Now, if those interest rates were to skyrocket like they did in the 1980s, we'd be in trouble. So we do have to take care, and we have been eating away slowly at it, and even that $3 to $4 million last year reduces it by some amount. But it's not a lot of a strain right now to carry it in our total operations. Mm-hmm. But I think you're right, we'll have to gain control over it. Last year, because of good market performance, we actually made a dent in our gap deficit, reducing it from $286 million down to $271. So I think those are positive. Again, the trend line is positive, although it comes with sacrifices. You can't do it without sacrifice. Any other questions? I'm sure there must be.
I have another question, if I may, we're thinking about how to generate or how units can be proactive and innovative in this current context. But given the constraints that we're dealing with, if I, for example, double my intake of students in my professional degree program, if all of that goes to reducing the current year deficit, it's good for the university, but I'm not benefiting as a department. So how can we get around this?
So actually, I'm not going to be able to give lecture 101 on the budget, but we do give all faculties that have additional enrollments get to keep a significant portion of the additional revenues that come in. There are three what we call aggressive incentives in the budget. One was enrollments, the second is endowments, and the third is research funding. And on all indirect costs, we're now starting with a base year of about 2009, any increases in enrollments are shared disproportionately with the faculties. And the faculties are now on anything over 2009 levels are getting 50% of the indirects for research grants. And if an endowed chair pays the salary of a professor, we provide an additional 50% to the faculty for discretionary spending. So there are incentives for doing that. Unfortunately, you can't negotiate that with me publicly. You can negotiate it with your dean, because that's the level that we budget to. So when we look at the faculty level, we give those incentives into the dean's discretionary funds. Yes, in the back. Well, I often joke that my first administrative job at McGill was to be the chief information officer, the VP for information systems, and I always thought that good information systems were based on hardware, software, and data. And then I got into the James building, and I realized that good information systems at McGill are gossip, rumor, and innuendo. So if you're there's right now, we're not exploring actively any of that. Concordia, however, did have a voluntary departure program which affected people at any level of seniority or age at the university. But we did not explore that right now. We have a regular retirement program for professors which has been active but didn't do as well as the earlier version, which my colleague labeled the retirement incentive plan. That one has not been renewed either, and this voluntary plan had a termination date. The problem is that people expect that something's going to happen. They'll wait until something better comes along, and we made the plan very clear. It was last year. It was an opportunity, and it was 256 of 512 people who were eligible took us up on it. So we haven't. I can honestly say we have not explored that. I haven't seen any paperwork on it. It could come up, but it hasn't. Yes.
What about the additional week that was given? I think about 2.5 years ago over the Christmas holidays to all staff to help reduce costs. What I'm referring to.
So it was in lieu of a pay increase, and it was a one time only. Right? I think Lynn Gervais is here. It was one time only. It was to cover the fact that in that 1 year there would be no pay increase, and so additional days off were given. But that's...
How much money did that generate?
It didn't generate. It's,
I mean, not generate, but how much money did it?
It was 0.something%.
Okay.
Or 1%, sorry. I'm sorry. I don't remember the exact number, but it was not... to generate, it was given back in lieu of. Right? And the work still was there when the people came back. Right. It didn't go away. Well, if there are no... yes.
I guess I've gotten the impression that there might be some reductions to faculty budgets.
I can't hear you.
Presentation. For reductions to faculty budgets, are they going to be dictated, or faculty going to have a lot more flexibility within their budgets and what to cut?
Right now, I said earlier, we're not clawing back any budgets. We're simply putting restrictions on expenditures, which may, in effect, have the same effect. Right? You can have it, but you can't use it. But we're looking at the implications for fiscal year 16. And in fiscal year 16, the positions that have presently been advertised for professors will be filled. So that's going to put... And we have agreements on salary increases with unions as well as associations. They have to be budgeted. So in January, we'll know better what the implications are, we hope, for fiscal year 16. Although in informal conversations with bureaucrats in the ministry, they're not going to know their 16 budget until after we submit ours. So what will be in... My successor will be in the same position that I'm in now. They'll have a budget in place, and 3 or 4 months later, they'll say, oh, that, remember those orientations? Well, here are the new regs, and they're different. So we don't expect that the government will be in a position to give us budget rules for fiscal year 16 until fiscal year 15 is done. And by then, it's too late for us because we have to submit a budget before that. Well, thank you all for coming, and thank you who are listening on the web, and we'll keep in touch and we'll keep you informed. Thanks again.